Furious Barack tries to turn back clock. Barack Hussein Obama sensing his days as the top dog of the whole world. His days are slipping away like sands through the hourglass. And being challenged by Trump as to what real leadership looks like, he's fighting back the only way he knows how, by backstabbing, passive-aggressive behavior, sabotaging, and even lecturing others on how to live. And it's all starting to blow up in his face as Russia laughs at his sanctions, tweeting a picture of a lame duck. How insensitive. And as Israel denounces him for his terrible double cross on Palestine. But Barack Hussein Obama, I have a news flash for you. There is no way back machine or Back to the Future function. That was just a movie. It's too late. You had a chance and you blew it, buddy. And your pal Kerry and his fake liberal mojo and evil stink eye cannot create a new world order either. Just by getting up and lecturing others on how they ought to live, even if it's impossible. Impossible standards for mentally challenged New World Order globalist liberals. And like King Canute, the old Irish king who said, if I walk out into the water in the ocean and tell the waves to stop coming in, is that going to work? And of course it didn't. So Mr. Barack Hussein Obama, you cannot lead just by telling others how the world ought to be, acting smug and above others, smarter than everybody else, dismissing disagreements with a wave of your hand and laughing when folks challenge you. Game over. Game, set, match, little fella. Time for a new leader. Good morning, 608 Kelly O'Connell. Here, and I couldn't help but notice, maybe you agree, maybe you don't, Frankie, yes, I do apologize for hanging up on you the other day, but really, if you call in, don't talk all the time, don't talk 100% of the time. Frank, you might disagree, but the fact of the matter is that there is something that's really bothering our dear leader in a way that didn't bother Reagan, didn't bother Clinton, didn't bother Bush. It seems like he seems to think that something should have happened that didn't, or something will happen that wasn't supposed to when Hillary got elected. You know, it's just, it's a real shame. But it seems like Obama is coming to the realization that he blew his chance to be a leader. You know, everybody has a different temperament, different intellect, a different approach, different personality. But I cannot imagine that Barack Obama is looking at his legacy, which is about to go up in smoke. I cannot imagine that this guy is sitting there thrilled with himself, because even though he seems to be the king of delusional thinking and blowing smoke up people's you-know-whats, it would appear that It would appear to me that Barack Obama is not sitting comfortably with how his legacy is about to be flushed down the old commode. And that's, I think, a lot of what's going on around here. And what's the old saying? What's the poet? Don't go meekly into that night. Rage against the dying of the light. So Obama is, his administration is dying because the clock is running out on him. So his his time in office is almost over, and it seems like he's a very unhappy person, right? So why is he unhappy? Well, to just cover it real quickly, he came into office. He didn't have the experience to know, you know, he hadn't spent years in the Senate. He hadn't come up through the House where bills are made, and there has to be a certain amount of cooperation because there's 453 people that you have to deal with. He was born into the Senate and almost immediately ran for president. So when people said it doesn't matter if you're the greatest genius of your age, the greatest speaker in history, doesn't matter if you've never been in office. And they really did, and I wish I had saved all these articles that I saw. Articles written at the beginning of his presidency on how his presidency was the greatest of the great. I mean, people were so deluded, you know, getting the Nobel Peace Prize and all that. But not having experience had a practical problem. He didn't know how legislation was created, and he apparently didn't take a lot of time to learn this stuff because he was, and I think this is Ed Klein in his book, The Amateur. I read this in there. Obama thought if he got up and gave a speech and people were inspired by it, they would leap to their feet and create an instantaneous army. Just giving a speech would motivate people, and those people would organize themselves to carry out the speech of the master. And so that's not really what happened. And as opposed to that happening, what occurred was over time, Obama stopped wanting to give speeches because he was getting a lot of criticism. And his presidency was increasingly seen as a disaster, not just a disaster in ideas, but in execution. And so he ended up not having a lot of stuff to boast about, one of which was Obamacare, which by some miracle he squeezed through and is now DOA. I mean, the increase in costs and the shrinking of the number of insurers and the smaller menu of items available and these incredible, $5,000 deductible not deductible, but you know what I'm talking about. Got to get over a $5,000 threshold before you get paying from the government or from the insurance. Anyway, it's dead, and Obama wasted his time instead of trying to figure out how to make real change on his convictions. He went around and pretended, put out, and apparently this is how he got to where he was, the old Peter principle, people rise to their level of incompetence. He projected this image of being a world genius. Now, I would feel, and you might say rightfully so, for good reason, I would feel very nervous if people began to talk about me like some world genius, because I would think to myself, this is just setting me up for failure, you know? And apparently Obama had the kind of psyche or ego in which he could never say no to a compliment. So he only ramped up expectations by allowing people to say all this crazy stuff about him. And I think that part of that was a genuine delusion. I believe he was yet another one of these liberal messiahs who thought he was going to change the world, who thought that he was going to give birth to a new world order, a term I don't really use that much because it's freighted with all of this, you know, conspiracy and stuff. But I think, you know, it's become obvious the globalists do have a new world order in mind, whatever it would exactly look like. And I think Obama believed, and you saw this time and time again, you saw the collusion between Obama and Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi. It just so happened that in Harry Reid, Obama had a guy that was willing to kill hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bills before they ever got to the Senate floor. So that protected Obama from looking like a complete nincompoop with all of these oppositional Republican House bills coming up. And with Nancy Pelosi, he had just a complete dingbat who was, you know, getting up and saying crazy stuff that should have gotten her thrown into prison, like, let's pass the bill and then find out what's in it. I mean, I really think that one idea there is should be sanctionable by a prison sentence, because you cannot represent the people that you were elected to do if the bills that you're promoting have not been read and understood. You can't know if you're representing people. And on top of that, the bill was a disaster. And Nancy Pelosi, like Harry Reid, like the president, and I'm just summing up these last years. We're getting up on New Year's, and this show is not going to have enough time for what I want to talk about today. But I just want to remind you what we've been through: 8 years of fantasy land, 8 years of let's build a better socialist world, 8 years of if you disagree with me, you're mentally retarded, 8 years of underperforming economy, 8 years of absolute total foreign policy failure, 8 years of people talking down to you and treating you as if you're intellectually not even on the level of an amoeba. 8 years of trying to break the border so that anybody who shows up on the border realizes that they're an American citizen, and taking resources away from real American citizens and giving it to these people that just showed up, and pretending the people that just showed up were as worthy as the baby Jesus. And not worrying if all of the people from Syria that you're bringing in, which by anybody's reckoning must have hundreds and hundreds of jihadists in it, not worrying, not pretending the fact that you can't background check these people out of this jihad zone, pretending that doesn't matter. All of this, what we were talking about yesterday, gaslighting, pretending that there's only one way to see the world, and if you don't see it that way, you're going crazy. And don't worry about seeing if other people agree with you, because you need to sit down and shut up. All of this so-called leadership. And then Obama backpedals. He doesn't know where to go. He falls on his big fat rear end when he gets challenged. And that's where we are now. He didn't get out of Israel. He didn't get out of his foreign policy what he wanted. So he buried a hatchet into the back of the Israelis. But it's just symbolic. I mean, it'll do damage, but we can repair that. But, you know, his attacks against capitalism, all of his red tape, are blowing up in his face, because now that we see, Trump coming in, every single day there's a new story about, for example, was it Sprint? A couple of days ago, we're gonna bring in 5,000 new workers. In an economy that appeared to be shrinking ever more rapidly, just one new face in the scene, and all of a sudden jobs are coming back and people are hiring and building and such. And if you're liberal, God bless you, but I want to see the proof of liberal policies, the effectiveness. I've never seen it, and I don't believe I ever will. You know why? Because it goes against the laws of human nature. It goes against history. It goes against common sense. And it goes against every law that we've ever discovered dealing with economics. Kelly O'Connell, 6:21 on the button. We'll take a break here. Got a lot on the plate today, too much on the plate, but we're going to get into it. 523-1450 on AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. You're listening to KOBE. We'll be right back.
lover in the grocery store. Snow was falling Christmas Eve. I stole behind her in the frozen booth, and I touched her on the sleeve.
All right, so there is an excellent article, well, statement that has been put out by this guy that has the Young Turks. And this guy that has the Young Turks is usually kind of a idiot, but he's got a great question here. Question is, did Barack Obama destroy the Democratic Party? Now, since this is kind of a retrospective show, kind of looking back the last show before New Year's, by the way, Happy New Year's, and I hope that 2017 is a remarkable year for you and you're able to reach more of your goals and have, you know, more personal success than you've ever had. But when Obama came in to office, he had the unmistakable sense that he was not just a world-class intellect. Because, I mean, how can any normal person go from being in office for 100 days as a senator and become president and be trusted with the greatest democracy, the greatest republic ever seen, the most powerful country in history, unless they were a super spirit, a world spirit. And as we saw slowly evolve, the narrative unraveled. And the fact of the matter is that Obama is nothing but super incompetent. But he came in because he didn't apparently, and still doesn't to this day, know how to put a real group of people together. He doesn't know how to attract and lead a movement. The only thing he seems to understand is how to get elected. And he basically laughed at anybody. You remember these news conferences where there was all of this fawning. Here's this guy up reading these, sandwich boards. What are those electronic sandwich boards called? The teleprompters. He's getting up, reading those, and people are marveling at how he's the greatest speaker in history. Pardon me, but did Julius Caesar or Cicero or Demosthenes, for that matter, supposedly the greatest speaker of the ancient world, did these people get up and have someone holding up cue cards that they read off? So, the media willfully obstructed the fact that this guy was the emperor with no clothes, but Obama continued with this illusion that he was super competent, and he made one mistake after another. But maybe the biggest mistake that he made is he didn't lead. You remember when he had the oil leak in the Gulf? What was that called? The Horizon, that thing that blew up on the bottom of the floor. And it was, even Bill Clinton came in and said, we got to stop this thing, even if it means putting a nuclear weapon down there and blowing it up. And then some genius, anonymous engineer came up with this a means of capping it. But, when this stuff happened, Obama seemed like he was so distracted, and he didn't. He couldn't lead on the issue because he doesn't know how to lead. That's my impression, and I think that's accurate. Not really comfortable with leading. He's comfortable with being a community organizer or kind of taking pot shots. But we've had 8 years of underperformance and non-performance, and Obama saying, you remember, we can't drill our way out. When we were drilling our way out, and when the jobs and corporations leave America, there's nothing you can do. But Mr. Trump thinks he's got a magic wand to stop it. And then Trump turns around and not only stops companies from leaving by giving him incentives, something that the president was totally allergic to, getting involved in stuff like this because he is an enemy of capitalism, proven by his 8 years of under 2% growth. But, this delusion that he was under, that he was trying to get everybody to buy into, that I described before, he's a maitre d' of a hospice. He's a hospice maitre d', trying to make everybody comfortable with dying and death. Instead of fighting the disease, he comes in and says, here's your morphine, and let me put on a movie for you. While America dies. 6:30, Kelly O'Connell, AM, Las Cruces, AM 1450. 5:23, 1450. We'll be back. And there's so many things to talk about today.
Didn't recognize the basic first, but then her eyes flew open wide. She went to hug me and she filled her purse. Then we laughed until we cried.
And if you saw in the news, the president had spent more than $50 million on vacations. And there's, you know, one of the thing that I'm going to have in my mind till the day I die, probably, about Obama is the smugness, the sense of self-satisfaction and condescending view. And you know what's amazing? Everything was on party lines. All truth was on the liberal side. All falsehood was on the conservative side or libertarian, whatever. And that did a real injustice to this country because, you know, you have to fight to find truth. And if you're being led by someone who's totally blinded by party affiliation, and I believe he was because he didn't really have anything else to offer. He didn't have what it was claimed that he had when he came into office, which was a brilliant mind and extraordinary wisdom and uncanny levels of natural leadership. He lacked all those things, and he lacked experience. So on both a practical and theoretical level, he lacked the raw materials to be a great leader or even a good leader or even a competent leader. And so I think in future generations, unless they are also completely politically corrected and dominated by Marxism, which, you know, Marxism at some point is going to cease being something that people talk about seriously just because it's so destructive, it's so ineffective. But I believe future generations are going to look at this guy and say, you know, this guy was a total dud, you know? This is a rocket that blew up on the launch pad or just sat there and fizzled. All right, here is his Cenk Unger, however you pronounce his name. He's a Turkish guy, but I should say a Turkish background, but he's somebody who used to be on CNBC, but he was, or MSNBC, whatever channel is, but he was too liberal, so they kicked him off. But anyway, here he is saying something I think is probably fundamentally true, that it's the failure of the entire Democratic Party and the vision that caused the party to become unraveled.
On Morning Joe this morning. What do you call Morning Joe, Jim?
Morning Joe Ball.
Morning Joe Ball. Okay. And he said that Barack Obama had a good record. Don't forget, the Democrats actually won the popular vote, 2.8 million more votes in this election, and it was just 80,000, actually 78,000 people in three states that made a difference, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Those are all true. But he said, but then, on the other hand, you look at the destruction of the Democratic Party under Barack Obama's leadership, and you have to wonder, what were the electoral benefits that he gave to the party? He said he leaves them in a much worse position. The states are decimated. They lost control of the House and Senate. The governorships are decimated. Maybe he's a gifted candidate. He won election twice by substantial margins, but his legacy as a politician is a bit muddled by all that. So I am also split on this. I think that putting it all on Obama is not correct. It is the corporate Democratic Party, the DNC, and almost the entire party through and through, except for obvious exceptions of Bernie Sanders, Keith Ellison, Tulsi Gabbard, Elizabeth Warren, etc. But those are the exceptions that prove the rule, because almost everybody else. So you can't just say that it was Obama. On the other hand, Obama did Organizing for America, and he got this giant email list, all these things that are super, super, super helpful in politics. And instead of turning that towards policy, he basically turned it into his reelection. And then did he really use it effectively to get other Democrats to get elected? Well, you know, proof's in the pudding. Democrats didn't get elected. I mean, so they lost the House and the Senate, even though most Americans agree with them on almost every policy position. They lost the White House to a guy who is the most unpopular candidate we have ever had in American history. On the day of the election, his favorable numbers for Trump were 38%. His unfavorables were 60%. And he won. That's unbelievable. So is that mainly on Hillary Clinton? Of course it is. Is it partially on Obama? I think so. I mean, he's going around saying, I could have won. I'm sure you could have. But maybe you should have tried harder then to try to get your party to win, because I don't really care about the corporate Democratic Party, but I do care that Trump is president. So, well, if you had something, you had 8 years to unleash it, and so I think it's fair to say, hey, he didn't get them those electoral victories at the state level. 69 out of 99 state legislatures are Republicans in a country where almost every policy position the American people say that they are center-left on. Go look at all the polling. Don't trust me. Look at polling on every issue. Center-left, 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 okay? And so to me, I think the biggest issue is that Obama didn't make the case. I mean, Trump, for all of his idiocy and stuff, he gets out there and does a stupid alpha male thing, and in his own childish way makes his case. He says, I'm going to make America great again. Here's how I'm going to do it. Carrier deal. A guy saved, he says, you know, thousands of jobs and 700 jobs.
All right, so that is, I think, probably a relatively fair assessment. If socialism works, why does it have to be sold by policies in which lying is the predominant factor? You don't believe me, of course, if you're on the left, but remember how Obama sold his number one policy, Obamacare. He lied his rear end off repeatedly. If socialism is true, why do you have to, as John Podesta bragged to Hillary, why do you have to dumb down people to accept it? I mean, if I was part of a movement in which it was understood that for people to accept the ideas of my group, they had to have basic rudimentary education taken away from them, that would bother me. That would really, really bug me. And which is why I think it's not just an intellectual defect to buy into far leftism. It's also there's something else going on. And, you know, I guess Mike Savage says liberalism is a mental disorder. But there is, I've said it before and I'll say it again, a very unseemly and false switching out of true religion with this liberalism comes in. I was thinking about this the other day. You know, if liberalism is a false religion, in religion we talk about heresies. There's true ideas and false ideas. And so, you know, according to the Protestants, if you have an idea that you can't support from a biblical argument, then it's a heresy. And that's been the history of the church too, going back to day one. And you know, the Bible talks about a lot of, you know, the Bible itself deals with heresies in these arguments. And so anyway, liberalism is itself full of heresies. And one of the heresies is that politics can take the place of religion. Another heresy is the government can be a god. Another heresy is there's only, you know, the only thing that we can be sure about is what we have on earth. Therefore, we need to build a utopia. All of these are heresies, and they're extraordinarily destructive heresies because they misread reality. You know, so I'll just throw that out to you. I know it's kind of a something to ponder. It's something I've been thinking about for a long time. 6:43, and got one of the greatest New Year's songs of all time. This song by Dan Fogelberg, if you recognize it, 1980, Auld Lang Syne, is, I did some research, it's a real story. He ran into his high school girlfriend in the town that he grew up in the supermarket, and then they tried to go to a bar, and everything was closed, so they bought a six-pack and ended up sitting in the car for a couple of hours. So the story is autobiographical, but a great song. 6:44 a.m. Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, doing an autopsy on Obama and finding a lot of rotten stuff. We'll be back. All right, so we've got here a very interesting statement from the president. Check this out. The president is flailing, not just failing, but he's flailing. He's like somebody about to go underwater the last time.
President Barack Obama suggested that if he'd been allowed to run again, he would have won this year's presidential election.
I am confident in this vision because I'm confident that if I had run again and articulated it, I think I could have mobilized a majority of the American people to rally behind it.
In an interview with David Axelrod, Obama argued even those who'd criticized his vision for the country in the past would have voted in favor of it in November. Looking at polls throughout the campaign season, Obama might have good reason to be confident.
Well, then maybe not,
In this vision because I'm confident that if I...
Very confident guy, huh? A guy that... what would you call somebody whose main brilliance is in getting elected but doesn't have any leadership skills or knowledge or really... You know, I never even got the sense that it bothered Obama that he didn't know how to lead or didn't want to lead. I mean, that comes from your belly, right?
Barack Obama suggested that if he'd been allowed to run again, he would have won this year's presidential election.
I am confident in this vision because I'm confident that if I had run again and articulated it, I think I could have mobilized a majority.
Well, God bless you, Obama. I mean... Big round of applause for Barack Obama, who could have been elected again. But, you know, there's a great article here from a guy by the name of Bill Scherer, who says he was writing out of Politico. No, Obama probably wouldn't have beaten Trump. I mean, it's incongruous. It's an incongruity to claim that you would have, you know, that would be like saying that that would be like Obama saying, if I went back and ran against George Washington or Abraham Lincoln, I would have beat him. Because it's two different eras. I mean, you know, Obama wasn't doing too good during his only reelection campaign because he just didn't seem to have achieved anything. And then Osama bin Laden was killed. Obama has apparently spent a lot of time sitting around thinking about how great he is. But I mean, the proof is in the pudding, right? I mean, expand on the metaphor, you can't, and it's pointless to brag about being the world's greatest chef if you can't even boil a hot dog. So anyway, here's this article from Bill Scherer. No, Obama probably wouldn't have beaten Trump, and it's bad for the Democratic Party, and it's bad for the Democratic Party for him to say so, which I totally agree. We've already got this party that's been decimated. Obama refused to, as you recall, support other Democratic candidates, but when he did, it was a disaster. These candidates did worse with Obama. And how do you explain that? I think people wanted Obama to succeed because he was black, and America feels a lot of guilt and perhaps justifiable guilt. I mean, nobody alive has owned any slaves. Nobody listening to this show slavery ended 160, 170 years ago, something like that. But as an institution, as an undertaking, America, you know, most people would agree did wrong with slavery. And we fought the Civil War and we got rid of the institution. But I think people still feel guilty about it. Whether that's good or not, let me put it this way, whether it's appropriate or not, I mean, no person alive ever owned any slaves, so how much guilt is on us personally, but you can say the country, you know. But I think that people were pulling for Obama, and they voted for Obama, but I think it is part of this, there's kind of an analogy here, and the analogy is this. They're talking about Angela Merkel. There's a sense of guilt in Germany over over World War II and the Jews and everything. And so Angela Merkel, her father was a minister, and she's a very dour, kind of a self-righteous person like Obama. She brings in a million or more Muslims. Now, these Muslims don't fit in because, you know, regardless of what you think of the religion, they don't have the background to fit into a democracy because they were not raised in a democracy. They don't know what a constitution is, constitutionalism, a Bill of Rights, rule of law. None of these things existed where they were at, and they were puppets of propaganda. They get to move to this country in the West because Angela Merkel, one person said it was her personal vanity. I am personally better than anybody else because I'm bringing these Muslims in. I'm not just paying the debt to the Jews and to the world for World War II and Nazism, but I am personally establishing the fact that I'm better than other leaders, the other people. And I think that Americans were kind of a lot of people who voted for Obama patted themselves on the back and saying, not only am I not a racist, but I'm a great person and we have a great country because we elected this guy. But then after that, there's this failure to hold him accountable because of the logic on which he was elected. How could you bring in somebody like that and not give them every opportunity to succeed? And I think that's been a lot of it. So Obama seems like a personally likable guy. He keeps a smile on his face, you know. I think people look at him and they like him, or they want to like him. They want to support him in part because he's got an apparently friendly demeanor. On the other hand, because it is proof that they're liberal. It is proof that they are evolved and are good people. But the cost of that has been tremendous to this country. And, you know, this guy's going out, you know, he's going out with a knife in his hand. He's stabbing as many people as he can on the way out the door, including his own party. It's not good for his party what he did to Israel. And it's not good for his party a lot of the other stuff that he's doing. So just this article by Bill Scheer is basically, it's a different electorate now than it was when Obama was running, because we have learned, much to our chagrin, that Obama was not who he claimed to be, and his policies were not what they claimed to be. He came in and said he'd slash spending, it would be post-racial, it would be post-political, and then it was everything but that. It was only political, it was only racial, and it was the highest level of spending we've ever seen. And what's been the result? 8 years of frustration, 8 years of people saying we're on the wrong track, underperforming economy, the military people are you know, abandoning it, and foreign policy is an absolute joke, and we don't even have a border on our own country. Kelly O'Connell will take a break and come back, 523-1450 AM, Las Cruces. All right, so I don't want to spend all my time talking about Barack, only because his days, you know, everybody can see his shortcomings. Nobody is talking about how he's the greatest president in history. When he got up and said he was the fourth greatest president, was that during, I think that was during his first presidency. That's sad. It's sad to hear that. Not just that somebody would say that about themselves, but that he felt that way. I don't know. I mean, somebody who, you know, I mean, everybody tends to have a inflated view of themselves. That just appears to be a defect of human nature. But, I mean, this idea that you would get up and before you were finished, you would announce that you were the fourth best president in history. Boy, that is something else. And then to fail the way he has. I mean, if just to cap off the conversation, what are Barack's achievements? I mean, please don't tell me, by the way, that he stopped the second Great Depression, because studies have shown that the stimulus, the amount of money that was taken out of private investment, and the way that it was spent, it was disastrous, you know? Whether he knew it was going to be disastrous or not, I mean, the people who put that together were Nancy Pelosi and others, but he went along with it because he didn't know any different. But in any event, that's part of the danger of pretending that you know everything, is that there's nowhere to go. There's nothing to be learned. I mean, you can't ever apologize, because if you know everything, then you don't have the right to make a mistake. So anyway, I hope that people look back at Obama and see him as a person who he's just kind of a con man, really. I mean, he got it to work for two terms. I mean, you could argue he's the greatest con artist in history, but he didn't have the stuff. I think partly because he didn't have an interest in people. He doesn't really seem to esteem people. He doesn't seem to like people on a personal level. And there's a lot of stuff that's been written about this, that when they had thrown a party, and then he and his wife had come down the stairs from their quarters and mixed with people for 5 minutes and then went back up. And there's this sense of disdain for politics, that he felt he was above politics, and a sense of disliking the people that are involved in politics, the supporters and everything, and that he didn't want to get himself dirty and wasn't interested in mixing with people. So, I mean, it's this kind of stuff. And the fact that, somebody who thinks they're above politics and doesn't even understand it, politics is exciting. It's interesting. You don't have to look down on it like it's, that you're personally above it. And I wouldn't look at his life and find anything that was above politics. I mean, all his life is his politics. So how can he look down on it? You see what I'm saying? And where does the purity come from that would cause him or anybody else to think that he was above? I mean, if his go-to move is always what the party stands for, then he's not above it. He is politics. And, I mean, this delusion that he's some pure character. I mean, his purity must come out of socialism, Marxism, or whatever in his mind. But when you apply pure Marxism, it's like hiring the Orchid Man to come out and, exterminate people. It is just, it's something that people don't survive. So anyway, I think that Obama is a lost soul who needs prayer. I guess that would be a most charitable way to put it. All right. I had talked to you about this clip that I had seen, and I thought it would be kind of interesting to get into this a little bit more. Jennifer Roback Morse, this lady that had talked, she is, and this is from Biola University, but she is an academic, a very smart lady, very insightful. She had an analysis on the failures of the romantic/family model in America, and I thought it was just kind of scintillating. It was interesting, her position. And some of the changes that have occurred. So just without further ado, let me play a little bit of this clip, and then 523-1450. You see if you like it. If not, then we can change the subject, but check it out. And by the way, this lady is a Catholic, so she put together, I think it's called the Ruth Institute for the Saving of American Marriage, the idea of marriage and the practice of it.
Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for this very kind invitation to be here and to address you at chapel here at Biola University. As Scott mentioned, as Dr. Ray mentioned, the mission of I'm the president and founder of the Ruth Institute, and the mission of the Ruth Institute, we used to describe it this way. We used to say that our mission was to promote lifelong married love to college students and other young adults by creating an intellectual and social climate favorable to marriage. That's what we used to say. But we figured out we weren't getting enough done fast enough. So no offense to you guys, but we branched out a little bit. But in the meantime, I want you to just be aware that we have a goldenrod yellow sheet that will allow you, if you wish, to sign up to be part of the Ruth Institute's newsletter, electronic newsletter. Everything's electronic. And so if you'd like to do that, we're going to be circulating those sheets around whenever the people think is appropriate to do that. Okay. So as I mentioned, we felt that we weren't really getting enough done fast enough because of some of the kind of setbacks that marriage has had in the political and legal spheres. I'm thinking of problems at the ballot box where marriage, for the first time in 2012, marriage was on the ballot in different places and natural marriage was overturned by the voters. And that had never happened prior to 2012. Up until then, we'd had a consistent ring of a string of wins in that area. But most of all, really, are the disastrous Supreme Court rulings. In past June, the Windsor case and the Prop 8 case. The court did not say we're going to impose same-sex marriage on the entire country in one fell swoop. That would have been sort of like a Roe v. Wade strategy of saying we're going to change everybody's laws instantly overnight. They did not do that. But what they did was to do a rolling Roe v. Wade. In other words, they put into motion a set of legal arguments which will, within a few years, result and come to the same result. So having all of that happen, we had to look at assess our use of time and say, are we really doing the best that we can do in terms of defending and explaining and promoting the institution of marriage and all of marriage, not simply dealing with the gay marriage issue, which is what everybody usually wants to talk about. So now, we've come to the conclusion, after a lot of soul searching, we've come to the conclusion that what we need to do is to focus a little bit less on the intellectual and academic. Because honestly, if these battles were about reason and evidence, we would have won a long time ago, okay? So it's not about reason and evidence, and that's kind of a bitter blow for me to accept because I really like arguments. You know, I really like figuring stuff out and getting data and stuff. And I didn't bring charts or anything, even though I have PowerPoint, I could have brought charts. But, you know, a good graph or table of numbers, I mean, that makes my heart beat fast, you know. So, but nobody cares. It's pretty much what I figured out is that nobody cares. And so at the Ruth Institute, we are now focused more on the emotional and the spiritual, because I think this is where the battle is really being fought, which is not to say that you ignore the intellectual and go stupid on yourself. Of course, you have to continue to not lose your mind, but we have to address the spirit and the heart as well as the head. And so now our mission statement sounds a little bit different. It's a little more casual, you might say, but I think it comes to the point. Our mission now is to clean up the mess of the sexual revolution.
All right, this is interesting, but I want to give you a little background as to something that is pretty fascinating. And there's a Oxford University has got a a little online paper, Oxford Art Blog, and this is from August 14th, 2014. Did love begin in the Middle Ages? Now, here's a fascinating fact for you. Nothing is discussed more and has been discussed more in the West probably in the last few centuries than love. Romantic love, especially in incorporeal lifelong love, real love as opposed to lust and all of these things. And there used to be a huge industry for pumping out love songs and movies, and they were invariably based on this idea of finding that one love. And there used to be this conceit, this belief in the culture that there was one person in the world that you were supposed to find to get married to. And then that marriage would be a lifetime bonding, and you'd have a family, and you'd build up your, you know, you would build up your generation of the family, and you would create a home where children that were reasonably civilized would come out of, and hopefully one of them would take over the world. But that all came down to lifelong love, to romantic love. What we call romantic love didn't really exist in literature. I mean, there in history, there are people going way back talking about falling in love or, you know, in the Bible and stuff. There's talk in the Bible of love, but in culture at large, the idea of romantic love and the way that it was developed was there was a change in, it came out of the West and the medieval culture. And so what changed in this is just kind of quoting from this article. So what changed in the Middle Ages, quote, there was a transformation in culture, said Professor Ash, who is the person who's they're quoting in this article, who is, in case you're interested, Laura Ash, associate professor of English at Worcester College and a faculty of English, and talking about romantic love in the literature of the Middle Ages, it doesn't really exist until the 12th century. And then a series of church reforms in the 12th century took Christianity from a rather austere or maybe loveless view of God the Father to a new focus of Christ's humanity. Quote, the spiritual lives of ordinary people were recognized, and people were encouraged to have a more emotional and personal relationship with God as individuals. And romantic love, giving yourself to another person, provides a justification in the medieval moral worldview for the pursuit of self-fulfillment as an individual. Even tragic love stories are based on the idea that the living individual is to be celebrated and that it might be better to stay alive after all. All right, so this is kind of fascinating, and this is one of these this is one of these things that I was telling you about. Our view of the world and the world itself has been conquered by the view from the West. The view from the West has been intoxicating, has been powerful, has been effective, and it took the whole world over. Not in every part, but, you know, you can't escape the influence of the West. Now, Professor Ash explained the changing attitude towards the roles of men and women may have played their part as well. These church reforms codified or made law that marriage is a sacrament requiring free consent from both parties. The woman's choice was actively required. So those of you who think that the church is the number one enemy of female freedom. And going on further, in addition, the rise of the aristocracy and a culture of conspicuous consumption created a courtly audience for romance literature with many wealthy female patrons. And that's that statement. And then there's another thing that I found from Washington State University, and the term courtly love was coined in 1883, but the concept of courtly love was from the medieval period. The medievals were the first to discover or invent, the first to express this form of romantic passion, the love story. There was no literary nor social framework for it in the Christian world before the end of the 11th century. And, stories like Beowulf or the Song of Roland, these famous ancient stories didn't have anything in there. So I'm just putting out there, we'll take a little break here, but the idea that we invented romantic love and it was beneficial because it created this entire, it wasn't just an industry of selling, Valentine's Day cards and chocolates and stuff like that. It was an actual kind of focus on the life of men and women and the potential for love and love as, and from the church's perspective, it would have been agape love, which was love as service. So two people finding each other and serving one another to build a life. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is that I think we have largely lost that in our culture. And so and it has been a spectacular impact. It's made a spectacular impact. And I don't think that I really don't think that we will ever. We will ever recover as a culture until we get some of that back, because I think it was central to who we were at one time. All right, so we'll take a break here, and we'll be back. 723 Kelly Connolly, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450 on KOBE.
That horizon was still just blue. In the line I wrote the shore and by walked out of gratitude.
So what are you planning to do for New Year's? I've got a little idea for you here. Cafe Go-Go, across from Sam's Club. And so they have a special New Year's menu, including grilled blue marlin loin, land and sea, seafood fettuccine trio. So go check them out, and going to be real tasty. All right, so getting into this this story with this what's happening to this culture, and one of the most significant changes I would say is the change between courtship, dating, and all this stuff. Now, putting it into terms of food, the dating cycle is now put dessert first and see if you like dessert and then go back on to the main course. So in the day, there was courtship, there was dating, there was a lot of, there was not a lot of free range sexual activity, and people looked for someone to date and get involved with. It was an entire approach to life, and it was a setup for marriage. Now, years ago, I mean, obviously it was a lot more, it was a lot tighter, but you know, as things developed through the 60s and 70s, there was still a courtship, even though the sexual revolution hit in the 60s, there was still a courtship, you know, a culture which has now largely dissolved. I just saw an article that said the demise of the dinner date. People don't go to dinner anymore. But if you meet somebody, you decide you're going to go to bed with them, you sleep with them, and then you decide from that, based on that, whether you want to date them or be having a relationship. There's something that is lost, and I think it is this romantic, this model of romantic love allowed a lot of very positive things to develop in it. And with that being lost now, it's gone across and it's affected the whole culture. We're now approaching people and saying, what can I get from this person? If I can't get anything from them, I'm going to move on. And, you know, the original statement that people made when they were married was, till death do us part. And if you don't have commitment in a relationship, you cannot achieve intimacy. Intimacy is not sex. Sex is an emblem. It's a symbol of being close to somebody. Real intimacy is, you know, a deep sharing or whatever. Anyway, here's a little bit more from Jennifer Roback Morse.
But we have a strategy for doing that. And our strategy is that we want to focus on the victims of the sexual revolution. We want to focus on the victims of the sexual revolution for some strategic reasons, which I'll explain as we go along. But first of all, let me just mention a few groups of people who could be reasonably considered victims of the sexual revolution. First, right off the top, the children of divorce. The children of divorce have been victimized by the whole ideology around no-fault divorce. And tomorrow's chapel will be exclusively on the subject of no-fault divorce, so I'm not going to talk too much about that right now. But I think it's pretty obvious that a lot of people have been wounded by that particular set of policies. Children have never really been heard from about what they thought about it, right? We hear about what the adults think. And we now actually have tons of social science evidence that shows that divorce has been harmful to children. The vast majority of divorces are harmful to children. There are some exceptions to that where there's serious dysfunction in the family and so on. But the vast majority of divorces don't involve that, right? And so the vast majority of divorces actually are harmful to children. And so the children themselves need the opportunity to speak and need to have somebody speak for them, and to say that they matter and what happened to them matters. Another group that you may have not heard identified before is a group that I call the reluctantly divorced. The reluctantly divorced. Now think about that. Most divorces take place against the wishes of one of the parties. All right, and because you have no-fault divorce usually means unilateral divorce. What that means is one party can end the marriage for any reason or no reason and never have to offer an account of themselves. And that means there's a person maybe who wanted to stay married, and the government takes sides with the person who wants the marriage the least. That's our idea of freedom somehow. Okay, so the government's taking sides with the adulterous spouse or the person who wants to leave just because they're fed up or something, you know. So that's another whole group of people who have never even been given a name. So I give them a name, the reluctantly divorced. And by some estimates, 3/4 of divorces involve a reluctant spouse. That's amazing when you think about it. Another class of people that are victims of the sexual revolution, this is a group that's coming down the pike at us, I would call the donor-conceived persons. The donor-conceived persons have a whole list of issues, a whole set of things that are of concern to them that no one is listening to, that no one is taking seriously. So that's another whole group of people kind of coming at us. We can think of many victims of the hookup culture. Many people are victimized by the hookup culture. And again, we could do a whole talk on that subject of people who have been lied to and victimized and who were expecting something that didn't really work out the way they were led to expect that it would work out. So all of those are victims of the sexual revolution.
One of the things that this lady mentions, and we'll take a little break here, but that I found fascinating, was that one of the explanations for the hookup culture now is that there's a lot of loneliness out there. And so people who are lonely that maybe wouldn't have been lonely decades ago because there would have been a family structure or there would have been a marriage that they were in, these people who are now, let's say it could be male or female, but their life is structured in a way in the culture itself dictates that there's a lot more lonely people out there. They're trying to deal with their loneliness with hookups, which is probably, I would have to assume, making the problem worse because, you know, a hookup is temporary and loneliness is more of a permanent problem. 734, Kelly O'Connell, and 523-1450. I will deviate from this after a few more minutes and we can get into our lists, the lists of 2016. Be right back. 523-1450 on AM Las Cruces. You're listening to KOBE.
Went to hell over the drink or two, but couldn't find an open bar. We bought a six-pack at the liquor store, and we drank it in our car.
All right, so a little bit more on this story. Well, I'm not going to play any more out of this this lady, Jennifer Roback Morris. It's just something to think about. But, you know, there was, I think a lot, you know, we talk about quality of life, I think that the impact of the sexual revolution and then this kind of atomizing of the family that followed up, and she had said something the other day when I was playing a clip, and maybe it was when I was at home listening to her, but the friendship is impacted by your view of romance, you know? I mean, if your idea of romance is everything is temporary, how are you going to be transitioning into friendship and be a great friend? So one of the things that I've noticed in this generation coming up is friendship doesn't seem to be that important, or it is it's kind of anecdotally important to people's lives, whatever they're into. So I think people are a lot more self-centered. They're a lot more technology driven, but at the same time, they don't seem to have something that was taken for granted decades ago, which was some close personal friendships, lifelong people that had your back and such. And I think that's one of the things that is driving loneliness in this culture is if you don't have a friend, you know, at least one or two people to talk to, who do you share your life with? I mean, what's your life about? And so, I mean, that's kind of an open question, but looking here for lists for you, top 10 list, top 10 rated movies of 2016 by critics. Number 10, Jackie. Number 9, L. Number 8, The Handmaiden. Number 7, OJ, Made in America. Number 6, Arrival. Number 5, Hell or High Water. Number 4, Tony Erdman. Number 3, Manchester by the Sea. Number 2, La La Land. And number 1, Moonlight. I've never even heard of the vast majority. I got to like one movie a year. So, anyway, wow, there's a lot of lists out there. Let's crack this one right here. Top 10 books in 2016. Number 10, Garth Greenwell's What Belongs to You. Number 9, Susan Faludi in the Dark Room. Number 8, Paul Kalanithi, What Becomes Air. Number 7, Adam Haslett, Imagine Me Gone. 6, Matthew Desmond, Evicted. Number 5, Zadie Smith, Swing Time. Number 4, Han Kang, Vegetarian. Number 3, Nathan Hill, The Knicks. Number 2, Gyasi, The Homegoing. Number 1, Colson Whitehead, The Underground Railroad. I do not read modern fiction, so I'm totally unaware of this stuff. All right, let's take a little break here and come back and get into some more top 10 lists. AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. 523-1450. All right, so some of your lists, which I've got right here. The worst pop culture of 2016. Number, well, I don't know if this is what number. It doesn't matter. Harambe, the ape that was shot when the little boy fell in the water in the Cincinnati Zoo. And there was a Harambe meme, you know, a little the little picture with you know, sent around, and well, the people at the zoo didn't find it funny, the making fun of a Harambe after he was shot down. Oh boy, some of these. Well, anyway, let's just say that was a bad story. Some of these sites don't even list these things. So I've got here for you, we've got the top funniest news stories of 2016. We'll have to come back on that one. And I don't see the same. Oh, all right. So here is the list of the top 2016 news stories from AP, Associated Press, world's biggest press organization, journalist organization. And the AP poll says, here are the top 10 stories. From 10 to 1, Hillary Clinton's emails. Story number 10, I think that's like number 2 or 3, isn't it? Amid the presidential campaign, the FBI conducted an investigation into Clinton's use of a private computer server to handle emails she sent. All right. Oh, and stories that didn't make it. The death of Fidel Castro was one. The spread of the Zika virus was another one. All right. Number 9, Supreme Court. The death of Antonin Scalia. Top 9 story. Number 8, Syria. Repeated ceasefire negotiations failed to halt relentless warfare among multiple factions. 7, Democratic Party email leaks. The hacked emails, the WikiLeaks, revealed at times embarrassing details from Democratic Party operatives in run-up to Election Day. 6, attacks on police. Ambushes and targeted attacks on police officers in the U.S. claimed at least 20 lives. 5, worldwide terror attacks. Across the globe, extremist attacks flared at a relentless pace throughout the year. Such attacks targeted the airport in Brussels and Istanbul, a park teeming with families and children in Pakistan, and the Seafront Boulevard in Nice, France, where 86 people were run down when a truck plowed through a Bastille Day celebration. In Iraq alone, many hundreds of civilians were killed in repeated bombings. Number 4, Pulse nightclub massacre in Orlando, the worst mass shooting in modern history, unfolded on Latin night at the Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando. The gunman, Omar Mateen, killed 49 people over the course of 3 hours before dying in a shootout with SWAT. During the standoff, he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. But I'm sure, according to the left, that doesn't mean he was a Muslim terrorist, you know, radical Islam. 3, black men killed by police. One day apart, police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, fatally shot Alton Sterling after pinning him to the ground, and a white police officer shot and killed Philando Castile during a traffic stop in a suburb in Minneapolis. 2, Brexit, confounding pollsters and odds makers. Britons voted in June to leave the European Union, triggering financial and political upheaval. David Cameron resigned immediately afterwards. And the Conservative government is now led by Theresa May. The number one story, as you know, the election, this year's top story, Donald Trump getting elected president of the United States. Isn't that fantastic, folks? All right. And here are the top 10 business stories of 2016. Fake news fears. Fake news bubbled up during the political campaign and became a business issue for the place where many people get their news, Facebook. 9, pressure on free trade. Decades-long movement towards free trade and globalization appeared to stop in its tracks as presidential candidate Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton both vowed to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have relaxed trade restrictions with Asian nations. And Trump is also threatening to pull out of NAFTA. 8, the U.S. dollar shines, surging to levels not seen for 15 years. Oil prices plunged. That was number 8, the dollar shining. 7, oil prices plunge, then rebound, falling below $27 per barrel, and now up over 50. 6, unemployment rate falls. Unemployment rate, which hit 10% in 2009, continued its remarkable descent, falling to 4.6% in November, then 5% in the early year. Didn't help Hillary too much. 5, Wells Fargo scandal. In September, a San Francisco-based bank agreed to a $185 million settlement with federal regulators after an investigation showed Wells Fargo had secretly opened millions of unauthorized deposit and credit card accounts that weren't authorized by customers. Four, prescription drug prices bring controversy. Number three, Dow closes in on 20,000 at the end of this year. Number two, Brexit, the leaving of the United Kingdom. And number one, Donald Trump elected president. Again, top business story. And we'll take one more break here and come back. Kelly O'Connell, AM Los Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. You're listening to KOBE AM. All right, what are the top stories in New Mexico, Las Cruces for 2016? I think one of them is that the two members of the county commission were voted off. That was a big one. I don't know what your stories are, 523, 1450, but locally, you know, that was a pretty big deal. I think, you know, the story about them throwing bottles, wine bottles off the hotel up in, was it Santa Fe? Was a big story. Top New Mexico baby names of 2016. Number one, Mia, female, male, Elijah. Number two, Sophia, female. Number two, male, Noah. Three, female, Olivia and Michael. Four, Emma and Liam. Five, Isabella and Josiah. Six, Ava and Sebastian. Seven, Emily and Ethan. Eight, Sophia and Jacob. Nine, Abigail and Aiden. And the top one, or the last one, Amelia and Lucas. Um, Well, there was a story published yesterday in the Biz Journal, top 10 stories for New Mexico, but you got to be a subscriber, so oh well. And let's see what else you might find interesting. All right, top news stories of 2016, Flint, Michigan water crisis in January 16. Mid-January, Zika virus outbreak expands. February 1, Iowa caucuses kick off primary season. Early February, Russia, U.S. participate in Syria peace talks. February 13, Justin Antonin Scalia dies. And March 1, Clinton Trump wins super primary Tuesday. March 16, Obama picks Merrick Garland for Supreme Court. April 16, earthquake devastates Ecuador. April 20, Harriet Tubman on a $20 bill. Wow, that's a big deal. Music legend Prince dies April 21st. And NASA announces 1,284 planets found in May. Officers found not guilty in Freddie Gray case May 23rd. Obama visits Hiroshima May 27. Kind of running out of time here. Deadly shooting at Orlando nightclub June 12. United Kingdom votes Brexit June 24. Pokemon Go instant hit July 6. Bastille Day terrorism July 14. A DNC emails hacked July. Donald Trump wins Republican nomination. Well, we're running out of time. Thanks for tuning in. Really enjoyed spending this year with you and look forward to you hanging out next year. And I'll see you back on Monday. Kelly O'Connell, I'm Las Cruces. Happy New Year, folks.
Doing well. I said the audience.